Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. I want to begin by talking about an anti-colonialist project. Not Palestine, although that is involved, but Standing Rock. We live at a time when solidarity movements talk about intersectionality, the linking of movements because of their commonality. This Week in Palestine features the Palestinian voice expressing the Palestinian narrative, and that is where we begin today, with the words of Nada Elia, a Palestinian scholar, writer, and grassroots organizer. As a Palestinian, the resistance of Native Americans at Standing Rock resonates with her, as it does with many others. Standing up to the colonizers unites the oppressed. The following are excerpts from an article featured in Mondo Weiss. Nada Elia writes, and I quote, "Once again, I seem to be glued to my monitor, this time streaming live scenes of the confrontations at Standing Rock in North Dakota. Thousands of unarmed civilians are being attacked by heavily militarized police and private security as they seek to protect their lands, their natural resources, their cultural heritage. Succinctly expressing the outrage of many over the latest violations by the United States of a treaty with the indigenous nations of this continent," Stephen Saleta wrote a post on Facebook that immediately went viral. Quote, "The current buildup of tremendous force at Standing Rock should be understood as a military invasion of a sovereign nation on behalf of a foreign oil company," unquote. And once again, as they have for centuries, the rightful owners of this land are determined to defend it, its life-giving water, its sacredness as a repository of culture. This time, the water protectors are calling for support, solidarity, greater numbers, and thousands of activists are joining them or sending what they can from widely circulating lists of supplies. The Standing Rock Sioux Nation's defiant resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline seems to have galvanized grassroots popular support throughout the United States as well as globally. Individuals and groups, many representing indigenous nations, are heeding the call to come stand with the protectors. Standing Rock matters, even if we are not all impacted. Of course, the intersections between Standing Rock and the struggles and resistance of various other communities are many. Palestinians see themselves in the Sioux, a long vilified nation still standing strong against the onslaught of settler colonialism. "Standing Rock is Palestine," one friend asserted as he announced his decision to go to the warrior camp for a second time. Nada Raja Tanos, who was part of a Palestinian caravan that recently went there from California, wrote eloquently, passionately, about the intersections between the Palestinian and the Sioux resistance to settler colonialism, land dispossession, theft of resources. "Why did I go in the first place? Because somewhere in the awkward power dynamic of being a U.S. citizen, a non-native inhabitant of Turtle Island and a Palestinian in the diaspora, I saw the struggle for livelihood and culture. The struggle against settler colonialism, the struggle to protect the sacred and maintain your own legitimacy, and the ever ominous force of erasure and historical amnesia. Black Lives Matter also issued a statement noting the many connections between the two disenfranchised, criminalized communities. Quote, as there are many diverse manifestations of blackness, and black people are also displaced indigenous peoples, we are clear that there is no black liberation without indigenous sovereignty. Environmental racism is not limited to pipelines on indigenous land, because we know that the chemicals used for fracking and the materials used to build pipelines are also used in water containment and sanitation plants in black communities like Flint, Michigan. Unquote. Climate change activists are also heading to Standing Rock, outraged at the thought of yet one more pipeline potentially poisoning the soil. It is not a matter of if a pipeline breaks, it is a matter of when a pipeline breaks. There are no safe pipelines. A spill will threaten drinking water for thousands of people, including the majority of the Standing Rock Sioux Nation. A spill will destroy critical farmlands of North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois, one group wrote in their manifesto. For many, the greater concern is not about the violation of Sioux sovereignty, but rather with a national dependence on fossil fuel and the environmental devastation any and all pipelines cause. The rallying cry seems to be, keep it in the ground, not respect indigenous sovereignty and sacred sites. But it is indigenous sovereignty and the Standing Rock Sioux Nation that matters. One of the most positive developments in activism over the past few years has been the growth and widespread understanding of intersectionality. An intersectional analysis allows us to identify and name manifestations of injustice as we experience them, even as we acknowledge that our experiences are similar but not the same as those of other communities. Thus, we stand with communities suffering from the same oppressive system, such as racism, for example, even if the manifestations of that oppressive system are experienced differently based on one's perceived race. Grounded in intersectional analysis, Palestine activists, environmentalists, etc., see themselves in and at Standing Rock. But Standing Rock isn't about Palestine. Standing Rock isn't about black lives. Standing Rock isn't about climate change. Standing Rock is about all of this and all of us together. But ultimately, Standing Rock matters because it is about the Sioux Nation and the indigenous people of this land. Indeed, settler colonialism never ended on Turtle Island. It is ongoing with daily violations of indigenous rights and treaties with the sovereign nations. When the water protectors say water is life, it is because their very survival is at stake. And as we respond, as we come together from all the nations of the globe, we reinforce the bonds of indigenous and transactional grassroots resistance that makes up greater than the sum of our parts. But ultimately, in whatever connections we may make to better understand this standoff at Standing Rock, we must center our indigenous concerns in this battle. Standing Rock is about indigenous sovereignty. As I follow the developments from my home in Salish land, I am humbled by the resistance of the rightful owners of this land over the 5 centuries since they were first colonized. Let us center their concerns, their rights, their history, as we stand with them always, literally, on their grounds. That was an excerpt from an article by Nada Elaya in Mondo Weiss. And now moving on. On Saturday, October 29th, a forum was held in Cambridge to address and help organize against the pushback by pro-Israeli groups to counter the worldwide Palestinian boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. Two of the keynote speakers, Nadia Ben Youssef of the Palestinian legal organization Adela, and Tamar Rabin of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, addressed the gathering, and we feature their presentations this morning on This Week in Palestine. The forum was organized by the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine, Mass Peace Action, and Jewish Voice for Peace. Here are Nadia Ben Youssef and Tamar Gobin.
So first we have Nadia Ben Youssef, who is a lawyer and human rights advocate, serving as Adala, which is the legal center for Arab minority rights in Israel. And she's the first USA representative. After 4 years leading Adala's international advocacy efforts on behalf of the indigenous Palestinian Bedouin community in the Nakab, or Negev, she is now developing the organization's U.S. Advocacy strategy to influence American policy and practice in Israel-Palestine. Much of her work in the United States has focused on building a transnational movement against supremacy and state-sanctioned violence, together with cause lawyers, community organizers, and artists across diverse movements for social justice. Nadia is a member of the New York State Bar and holds a BA in Sociology from Princeton University and a JD from the Boston College Law School. Welcome, Nadia. Tamar Gobin is a Palestinian-American organizer who works for the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, just recently formerly the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. They just changed their name. As the Government Affairs Associate. Additionally, she is currently the head of distribution for the Arab Students Institute's new pedagogical project, Gaza in Context. Tamar received her BA in International Affairs from Northeastern University in 2015. And as an undergrad, she was very active in the Students for Justice in Palestine and continues to be connected to SJP as an alumna. Susan Nicholson, welcome, Tamar. And Tamar is joining us all the way from D.C., so we're happy to have you come up. Thank you. So the three organizations that are worked on this event are Mass Peace Action, the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine, that banner has not been corrected yet, we too have changed our name, and Jewish Voice for Peace, JVP. And so we all three are in a group called the Joint Advocacy Group. As we were doing legislative work, it seemed silly to be doing it separately, and we thought, to combine forces and really figure out how to make this attack a joint effort. Resisting the attack on us. So, we hope you find this morning's session interesting and engaging so that we leave here educated and fired up to protect our right to boycott as we continue our work on BDS in support of Palestinian justice and liberation. Thank you all. Oh, one last thing. I just want to do a shout out to Standing Rock and show our solidarity.
Thank you so much for that introduction. Thank you to the organizers and certainly for all of you for being here 10 a.m. on a Saturday. I'm thrilled to be here with you, and I hope that it is a time for us to reflect, to build, to catch courage from one another, to start thinking strategically about what our movement for justice looks like. We've talked a little bit about how we're going to organize the day, and we're going to take you through a little bit of history, what's going on the ground, what's happening across the country, what's happening in Massachusetts, and then you'll break up into groups to really start thinking about what you can do, how we build power. And so hopefully by 1 o'clock you have a lot of information, you have a lot of energy, and you know kind of steps forward. This is going to be I hope a very encouraging morning. You're going to hear a lot about the powers against movements for social change, whether that's in Palestine, whether that's here in the United States, and it can feel discouraging because that power is strong. Students feel it every day on campuses. You'll hear about that. We feel it as civil society, as human rights organizations. You feel it as organizers, as community members. That power can feel very, very strong. But I think, hopefully, what you'll understand kind of at the end of this is that this is a very common tactic, a very common tactic to suppress activism and organizing. And it's, I think, very much a signal of how powerful we are. I think the response becomes much stronger the more that we build power. The response of those in power to try to silence those voices, to try to suppress protests and activism and organizing and certainly building coalitions is a sign, I think, that we're winning. I'm a human rights lawyer, so I'm eternally and relentlessly optimistic. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here, you wouldn't be here, but I think that's true. I think that's true. So what I would like to do is kind of provide a background to situate the emergence of this tactic, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, in terms, yes, of the struggle for freedom, justice, and equality in Palestine, but more broadly, in terms of how it's a symbol and a tactic and a tool of all struggles for justice around the world. So what I hope, too, is that when we leave, we're not just fired up for Palestine. You ended with a call of solidarity for Standing Rock. These struggles are interconnected in so many ways because these are struggles against structures and systems of oppression. They are struggles against settler, colonial, legal, political regimes. They are struggles against white supremacy. They are struggles against hierarchies of human life, hierarchies of rights. And so when we think about what our role is as organizers, as activists, as artists, as people who are concerned with justice in Palestine, as I know you are, this is why you're here, I want us to think that we are here not just because of that, but because we're concerned about a struggle for justice more broadly. So what I want to do is maybe bring us into some sort of a history about what's going on the ground, where this came from, what this struggle is about, and tell you a little bit about how Adala, as an organization, a Palestinian human rights organization and legal center based in Israel, is challenging that on the ground, and then how it relates to your work here. So, where does this come from? Again, I want to just reiterate what the call of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is. We have to remember what that is. Ending the occupation. If you don't know it in your head, write it down. Ending the occupation. So this is the occupation, the Israeli military occupation of Palestinian lands, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, the Gaza Strip, the Golan Heights. Ending the military occupation, which turns 50 next year. Turns 50 years old next year. 50 years of a military occupation. End the occupation, that's a call. But what's interesting is how this call then moves very quickly into two important points. Certainly ending the occupation. Then it goes to what we call a demand for historic justice. A demand for historic justice. That takes us to what's known as the Nakba. Is everyone familiar with that term? Are people familiar with that term? The Nakba, for those who are not familiar, means catastrophe in Arabic. The Nakba. It means catastrophe in Arabic and refers to the events of 1948 when the State of Israel was established. The vast majority of Palestinians became refugees, lost their land, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine begins here, the Nakba. And the ongoing Nakba is what the struggle for historic justice is about, right? So this, certainly the Nakba sounds like a historic moment. It sounds like something that has passed, has not passed. The effects of the Nakba are seen throughout the system of Israel, the system of the state of Israel, and we'll talk a little bit about that, how the system is designed, right? So the Nakba. The second call, one of the two next calls, is the right of return of refugees. So what happened during the Nakba? The vast majority of Palestinians became refugees. The second call of the boycott, divestment and sanctions call, is the return of refugees, historic justice, return of refugees. The final call refers to the Palestinians who remained inside Israel after the state was established. So the vast majority of Palestinians became refugees, a small number remained inside Israel and became citizens of Israel in 1952 through the citizenship law. There were 150,000 Palestinians at that time who remained inside Israel to become citizens of Israel. They now make up 1.3 million people, or 20% of the population of Israel. One in five Israeli citizens, is a Palestinian. One in five Israeli citizens is a Palestinian. The state of Israel was established as a Jewish state, right? It was established, we're going to get to why this is important, as a state that would privilege the rights of certain people on the basis of who they were. It's inherent in the Declaration of Independence, it's inherent in all the systems and structures and laws of the state of Israel, that we're going to create a state which privileges the rights and lives of certain people on the basis of who they are. The second call of the BDS, The third call that I'll discuss is equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel. So these calls, if we can summarize what it is, it's a call for historic justice. Historic justice, the return of refugees, the end of the occupation, and equality for all. These are human rights principles. It is a human rights-based call. This is a demand for historic justice and for equality. I want you to keep that in your arsenal. A few weeks ago, when we were talking about kind of organizing and going to Massachusetts State, the governor's office, to the attorney general to talk about this issue, the response was, I never knew this was about human rights. We thought this was about anti-Israel. We thought this was an anti-Semitic call. We're going to talk about that. We thought this was about discrimination against the Jewish people. We thought this was discrimination against Israeli settlers or Israelis. We didn't realize this was a call for human rights. This is a call for human rights, and it is protected on all sorts of levels. But just remember that it's a call for historic justice and for equality. I talked a little bit about how the system is designed. So, when the state of Israel was established, all of the laws, the policies, the practices were put in place to uphold its fundamental design. The state of Israel was established to privilege the rights of the Jewish people over anyone else on that land. It was established to privilege the rights of the Jewish people over anyone else on that land. The system was designed that way. When we think about what's going on in Israel now, which certainly, and we can talk about kind of the situation on the ground, which is degrading, certainly. It's a very scary situation on the ground for Palestinians, for human rights defenders, who are facing all sorts of real physical and other threats against their existence, certainly, all the time. So the situation on the ground is degrading, but we don't say that the system now is broken. In the same way that we don't say that the system in the United States is a broken system. It's not broken. The system is designed this way. The system isn't broken. The system is designed this way. In Israel, the system is, we're going to privilege the rights and the lives the citizenship and the power of the Jewish people over non-Jewish people on that land, Palestinians, but it also extends to refugees, to asylum seekers. Anyone who is not Jewish on that land has fundamentally less rights to power, to land, to resources. The system is designed this way. So that includes the law, right? The law is not a powerful tool, we often say. I'm a lawyer, I was confused by that, that's why I went to law school. I was like, this is going to be a powerful tool. It is not a powerful tool. The law is a tool of the powerful. The law is a tool of the powerful. The law is a tool of the powerful. The law in Israel is a tool of the powerful, certainly. So we look to the legal regime as to understand like how this works. And you're going to hear examples of how the law is a tool of the powerful. It's used to protect the status quo, to use to protect the systems and structures of oppression and of supremacy. Because who writes the laws? Who writes the laws? The powerful write the laws. Those in power write the laws. And those in power want to keep their power. Those in power want to keep their power. And anything that's a threat to that power, like the truth, like history, like justice, is going to be quashed. In 2011, so here we have just a bit of background in terms of where we were and how this struggle is playing out in Israel-Palestine, because I think it's really instructive about how it's playing out here and how you protect your rights to stand up, not for Palestinian rights, but to stand up against injustice wherever it happens. So here we go. In 2005, you have the call for boycott. Call for boycott, people are joining the call, including Israelis, including Jewish Israelis, Palestinian citizens of Israel, certainly Palestinians who are joining this call, who say, you know what? The system is designed, the system is rigged. Adela uses the system. I can talk about how we use the system, and I'll tell you a story now. But the system is rigged. How do we change the situation? And as we talked about in the introduction, this is a time-honored tactic, because when the law is designed a certain way, you start thinking, what are the other tools for social change? What are the other tools? The law might be a tool for social change, we'll talk about that, but there are other tools for social change. International advocacy, creating and mobilizing public and public outrage, that's a tool of social change. So the boycott started making waves, right? So people started joining the call for boycott, including those who lived inside Israel. As a response to this growing movement, and you'll hear about how this is taking shape across the country, in response to this growing movement, the Israeli Knesset, so the Israeli parliament, in 2011 passed what's called the anti-boycott law. In 2011. So you're going to see, actually, you're going to see how this works. So you have 6 years of a growing movement for Palestinian rights, a growing movement that's calling into question the fundamental nature of this structure and system of oppression, right? And calling into question the historic injustice of the Palestinian people, making waves. It's growing. It's building. And so what do the powerful do? They make that growth of a movement illegal. Law is a tool of the powerful. They're going to make it illegal. So, anti-boycott law said, we're going to create a new civil tort, a new civil wrong, that a call for a boycott is a civil wrong. And you can be sued in court if you call for boycott. If you as an individual call for boycott, you can be sued in court. Anti-boycott law, that was one part. The second part, which you'll hear resonance of this in this country, and when you're hearing anti-boycott laws being passed here, you'll hear resonance. The second part was that if you are a public institution and you receive public funds, this law said those public funds can be taken away if you as an institution call for boycott. Adala, a legal center based in Israel, Palestinian human rights organization, partnered with another human rights organization. So Adela, if we're talking about historic times, Adela is like the NAACP of Israel. So Adela, the NAACP of Israel, partnered with ACRI, the ACLU of Israel, to challenge this, ACRI is the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, to challenge this before the Israeli Supreme Court. We challenge this before the Israeli Supreme Court, saying that it is a fundamental right. Under international law, under international human rights, we use all of these examples that were discussed, certainly the 1982 decision in the United States. We brought that in. We brought in examples from South Africa. We brought in examples, and we lost the case.
No.
We lost the case in a close decision, but we lost the case because the system is designed a certain way, right? The system is designed. It's not going to give you those rights. We lost the case, but it's important reasons why we lost the case. The discrimination argument was really huge, and I hope we get into that. I hope we start teasing out why that's a false argument, the idea that those in power can be discriminated against. Not true. Not true. Discrimination is a system and a structure of power. It's not about individual prejudice. That can exist. There can be individual prejudice. But systems and structures of oppression make it impossible for the oppressor to be discriminated against. They created the system of discrimination. It can be discriminated against. So, but that argument held in the Israeli Supreme Court. It's being used here as well, so discrimination. We lost that case, but which makes it very difficult for organizations, institutions, individuals inside Israel, including Adela, to call for a boycott. So we actually don't call for a boycott. One, we're not a grassroots organizing. We're an institution. We are a legal center. So that's not part of our work, but it has a chilling effect. It silences those who are organizing for social change. We're fighting back. And people are fighting back. Because nothing, ultimately, this is getting a little cheesy, but it's true, can stop the power of the people. And I think that what we're seeing and what we're witnessing, again, as you're going to hear what's going on in this country, these like very similar laws being passed and being proposed in dozens of states are, I hope to you again, just an indication of how far we are going, how far we are coming, how far we have come, how big this movement is, how you are on the right side of history. And when you choose the side of the oppressed, you will always be on the right side of history. So I encourage you not only to think about how this impacts your right to speak out for Palestinian justice, but how it empowers you to speak out against injustice wherever you see it. So I'm really excited to build with you. Thank you so much. If you have any questions, we have that built into the schedule. So thank you so much.
Thank you to the organizers. Thank you all for coming out again on a Saturday morning. My name is Tamara Rubin, and I am the Government Affairs Associate at the newly renamed U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. As was mentioned earlier, we just changed our name a few weeks ago to represent this more rights-based framework. We're not just about ending the occupation, but we're also about right of return and equal rights for Palestinians inside of Israel, et cetera, et cetera. So we think that this name represents that more. And I'm going to be talking about the fight against BDS repression. So as Nadia did a very good job of sort of taking a step back and looking at this issue from both Palestine and Israel, I also want to sort of continue to do the same. I think that in the US we have often a very myopic view of our activism, especially when it comes to repression. So I just wanted to mention a few cases of what's happening on the international level. In Spain, in France, I just heard yesterday that in Northern Ireland, of all places, a council member of the Belfast City Council presented a pro-BDS motion, and the city council declared it illegal. Which is crazy. It's Northern Ireland, so that's...
Well, no. Yeah. Well, Ireland, Ireland.
Sure. Okay. But, I mean, it's indicative of, this more geopolitical global shift, especially with a party like Sinn Féin, which has traditionally been very pro-Palestine. Anyway, and then of course Palestine. This is why we do this work. Palestinians face repression every day. It's their lives. It's my family's lives. So I wanted to sort of just ground this talk and this whole day in both a recognition of a repression that's happening on the global scale and also in Palestine. Okay, so also yesterday, the EU affirmed the right to BDS, which is really exciting. So the EU, Mogherini stated that the EU stands firm in protecting freedom of expression, blah, 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 and including with regard to BDS. That's really exciting. That sets a huge precedent and can also be used, you know, hopefully in future lobbying and whatever activity, you know, you all decide to do. Okay, so what's happening on the federal level? There are two laws that have been passed and one bill that's currently still relevant with regards to BDS repression on the federal level. The first one is the Defending Public Safety Employees Retirement Act. And in it, there is a provision on a principal trade negotiating objective to discourage BDS. So that's one important bill, important law that you all should be aware of. The second one is the Trade Facilitation and Trade Enforcement Act of 2015. In it, there's a provision that establishes a presidential report to Congress on BDS. That was passed in February. Obama issued a signing statement saying the law wouldn't apply to settlements, but signing statements have no teeth, so it doesn't really matter. This is unfortunate. The third one, and most troubling, is the Combating BDS Act of 2016. And it authorizes state and local governments to divest from entities that support BDS. The one important thing to know about this is that it's unconstitutional. Congress cannot authorize states to violate the First Amendment, which is what these state-level anti-BDS do. Anti-BDS bills do is they violate the First Amendment. So we are worried about this. It's currently, as an amendment, it's been put as an amendment into the Foreign Operations Bill, and it also is still alive as a standalone bill. Luckily, government gridlock is working in our favor this year, so we'll keep an eye on that. Okay, I also wanted to just jump to US campuses. I'm not just talking about state-level stuff, I also want to mention other instances of repression. So if you are an activist in Boston, I'm sure you have been privy to the various instances of repression on US campuses. When I was an undergrad at Northeastern, we went through quite a bit of stuff with repression. And then just, I think, last week on Tufts campus, there were posters all put on across the campus that had pictures and names of students and professors who were active in SJP, calling them terrorists, blah, 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 essentially. And the David Horowitz Freedom Center is behind those posters. And those posters have also proliferated in San Francisco, in California, all across the country. David Horowitz got these names from a website called Canary Mission. And Canary Mission is a racist, McCarthyite website that started a year or so ago, and it has now over 400 students and professors' profiles on them who support Palestinian rights. And it's with the express purpose of preventing them from getting jobs or hurting their careers. It's a really awful website, but I recommend that you don't check out Canary Mission, you check out Against Canary Mission, which is why I put that up there, which is a great initiative from, I think, over 100 professors across the US who are fighting back against this repression. Yeah, so check out that website. I also just wanted to mention two recent instances of faculty repression. Dr. Rabab Abdahadi, who's at San Francisco State University, also was, her face was plastered on these posters. She's a Palestinian professor, saying that she's a terrorist, has ties to Hamas, whatever. And Dr. Steven Salida, who, if you don't know about his case, I would highly recommend you check it out. I want to mention that these are both Palestinian professors, and often, as is the case with many issues, those who are most vulnerable are Palestinians and people of color, queer folk, trans folk, when they're doing this work. That's just something to be aware of. And then, of course, there are the academic associations, American Studies associations, et cetera, that have passed pro-BDS resolutions, which is wonderful. But there are a number of frivolous lawsuits that are currently standing against these academic associations because of their pro-BDS stances. So is this repression working? I think it's important to look towards what the opposition is saying about it. And this is an article that actually Nadia pointed me to a few days ago, where the president of the Louis Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law said, "We are now at a point where, sad to say, the BDS movement has saturated the country to the extent that it is no longer so predictable. You can no longer focus on a discrete number of campuses." And then the second quote is, "Part of the idea behind moving the battleground to state legislatures is to find more favorable turf for the anti-BDS message." So there is a pretty big push from campuses to state legislatures because of this. And then I also just wanted to mention, we can't not mention, the churches and unions that support BDS and are doing a great job. And then also with the United Electrical Workers Union, there was a frivolous lawsuit against them, but it didn't go anywhere, so that's exciting. All right, so state-level anti-BDS bills. Unfortunately, they have passed in 12 states so far, including New York, which was an executive order. And what's important to note about New York, it's the first executive order of its kind, hopefully the last, but Governor Cuomo, passed this executive order a mere week before the legislature was set to close, which indicates, there were two anti-BDS bills still languishing in the state legislature, and this indicates to us that those bills were not going to pass. So he took an unconstitutional step and passed this executive order, but we're including it anyway. So the substance of these bills is that initially, you know, two or so years ago when they first started popping up in state legislatures, they were targeting universities, defunding universities that passed divestment resolutions, and that didn't go very far. And now they're a little bit more complicated, and they are divesting or boycotting or blacklisting entities that support BDS from pension annuity funds, state contracts, state funds. And what's also important to note is that a lot of these bills are already folded into existing anti-discrimination bills, and as Nadia stated before, BDS does not violate anti-discrimination laws. BDS is trying to end discrimination, right? But there's a disconnect between the intent and the wording of the bills, which is still, it's important to still fight against these bills when they're folded into already existing anti-discrimination laws. So there are a few state-level wins, which is exciting, in Wisconsin, Maryland, California, Delaware, Ohio, Massachusetts, sort of. Hopefully that momentum will keep going. New York and Virginia. And then I also wanted to mention this initiative called Governors Against United Against BDS. There are now over 30 governors who have signed this initiative. It's an American Jewish Council initiative. We don't really know if it's innocuous or not. It sort of appeared at the same time that Cuomo signed his executive order, so we were really scared that this meant that... It's in your packet. Okay, great. So it's in your packet. We were scared that this was going to mean that more governors were going to sign executive orders. But so far, that hasn't really been the case. These are just a picture of the governors that have signed. Massachusetts, your governor has signed. There have been some wins on the local level, which is also really exciting, both in Delaware and Woodstock. But of course, there are some anti-BDS bills and resolutions that have proliferated on the local level as well. So who's behind the bills? This is a really good question that we are always trying to figure out. So the Israeli American Council, the Chabad Lubavitch Hasidic sect, Proclaiming Justice to the Nations, which is a Christian Zionist organization, the Conservative American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, Israel, obviously, and other groups. Okay, so what is most useful to take away today? And I wanted to just put a few points up to get people to think about strategy and moving forward. So broad and diverse coalition building has been very successful. Massachusetts Freedom to Boycott, you all did a really great job of building a big and broad coalition. And it's also a really great chance to get free speech groups on board. And you know, when building coalitions, it's important to think about who you're including and whose voices you're privileging. So it's also a great opportunity to sort of use progressive coalition building tactics, amplifying Palestinian voices, amplifying people of color, etc. Just it's always good to be intentional about the way that you build your movement. Active and continuous lobbying, obviously, is a great tactic. In California, they had a very successful lobby day, and they were able to water down the bill there quite substantially. Identifying allies within the state legislature. This is so important. In Ohio, after the first vote on their anti-BDS bill, there was one member of the state legislature who just kept asking questions about the bill, very, like, almost innocently. And so they pinpointed him as a potential ally, and they talked to him afterwards, and they got him on board. And he came out against the bill, voted against it, you know, kept them privy to what was happening on the inside, and the bill didn't make it out of the committee. So presenting testimony at hearings, this is also very important. In Maryland, even before an anti-BDS bill was introduced, they went to a priorities hearing, and they filled the room. And some of the legislators didn't even know that there was going to be an anti-BDS bill introduced. And so they really got ahead of the game. They showed up at all the hearings, and the anti-BDS bill was never introduced. Of course, reaching out to media, op-eds, letters to the editor, editorial board meetings, press releases. Very important to just try as much as you can to get your message out there. Have call-in days, send emails, engage them on social media. And then the second to last thing is education of staffers and legislators. This is really important, and I think it's something that we don't focus on enough. You know, maybe if a bill passes, that sucks, but you're talking to people that you would probably never talk to. And so this is an opportunity to really engage with people that would never be a part of this circle, have no idea what BDS is, ever. So that's great. And then finally, keep an eye on anti-BDS media. This is another thing that Maryland, the coalition there, did really well. They kept their eye on the Jewish press, and the Jewish press said that there was going to be an anti-BDS bill introduced by this legislator, sponsored by these people, and that's how they knew to jump on board really early. And because of their work, the anti-BDS bill was never introduced. Okay, just quickly, legal framework. Obviously, this is really important to know. The state-level bills violate the First Amendment. Boycotts to bring about political, economic, and social change are protected by the First Amendment. You heard about the Supreme Court case, NAACP versus Claiborne Hardware. The Harvard Law Review concurs, and the National ACLU also concurs. Very important two sources to use in lobbying, etc.
That was Nadia Ben Youssef of Adela and Tamar Gobin of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, speaking at the BDS Forum in Cambridge on October 29th, 2016. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.